And more destructive. There have been, since Katrina, over $200 billion disasters. And as disasters have grown, this workforce has grown. And these workers do all this without legal protections, without legal status. They often have to fight to be paid. And if they fall off roofs, they're often left at the doorstep of hospitals for dead. This is how we're doing recovery in America. And that's what we at Resilience Force are trying to change.
Saket Soni, director of Resilience Force, author of the new book, The Great Escape, a true story of forced labor and immigrant dreams in America. Special thanks to photographer Ted Quant. And that does it for our show. Happy birthday to Messiah Rhodes. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio's final fundraising drive of 2022 was a tremendous success. Thanks to our listeners, our goal of $70,000 was exceeded. Stitching communities together brought folks together for the love of independent media. The beloved KBOO community extends gratitude to our members, supporters, staff, and board. And a big thank you to our volunteer programmers. Your on-air support was the backbone of this membership drive. Tax receipts are available. Please send a request to membership at kboo.fm. Since 1968, KBOO has relied on its members to support grassroots broadcasting. Thank you. KBOO.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is The Gap. My name is Tammy, and with me is the radiating Althea. How are you, Althea?
Hello. Hi. Good morning. What a fun song, huh?
It is a fun song. I had to hold my breath.
I need to adjust myself a little bit here. Folks, it's The Gap.
I'm Althea.
I'm here with Tammy. We have a little bit of a different show for you today. Normally, this is a call-in program, but we are pre-recorded because there's a power outage. But we planned it this time, and it's for the greater good and part of us getting reopened.
Taking people on the roller coaster of emotion. But yeah, I'm sorry, but
we're rolling with it, okay?
Part of the facelift that KBOO is having. And so getting things resituated and reacclimated. You know Pangea?
Yeah.
So one time, for listeners who don't know, once upon a time, there used to be these cute little furry dinosaurs everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Some of them had feathers, and they were living on Earth, but it was before the Titanic plates shifted around,
uh-huh.
Before there were continents, so there's Pangea.
I mean, that all sounds right to me. Keep going.
And so in order for us to be where we are now, change has to happen.
Yeah.
And sometimes we need power outages, and to get repower.
Yeah.
Like the Phoenix.
Yeah.
I'm just full of allegories.
It's good. Good. Yeah. We're powering down to power up, but we're still here, which is the important
thing.
Powering
down to power up.
You like that one?
Write that one down.
We're still here. We still got some great content for you. For the first part of our program here, we have an interview with Ryan McCavery from Past Lives about an event that's happening tonight called Call for Light, The Conversation. Past Lives is a gallery space that features art from people who are incarcerated or who are formerly incarcerated. So it's going to be a very interesting, you know, conversation about how prison impacts people who are incarcerated, how it impacts their families and the community. So
happening tonight, Southeast.
Happening tonight in Southeast. First, we have a little clip from Owen Bastable in the news department to get a little sense of their space, and then we'll go into our interview with Ryan. So let's hit it. We are speaking with Ryan McCabry, the Marketing and Events Director from Past Lives, about an upcoming event this evening. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. So Call for Light, the conversation happened last night on Thursday, and there's another one tonight. What can you tell us about this event?
Yeah, essentially it's facilitated by, we had a panel or an event December 9th, and we had artwork by the currently incarcerated showcase with Portland artists as well. And the currently incarcerated, we just had what we had. We framed it all and put it on the walls. And then we asked Portland artists to create work based on light. So we had lamps and drawings and illustrations coming in to illuminate the artwork for the incarcerated community during the winter. And kicking that off, I invited local communities and organizations that work with the people that are in prison and people coming out of families to talk about what they do so that they could reach a larger audience for their organization as well. And there were so many people that said yes. And I decided we should have a longer conversation over two nights. And that's what's happening at Past Lives.
And going back a little bit, can you tell listeners about the Past Lives Gallery?
The gallery is part of, we're Past Lives is a maker community. We have a full working wood shop and a metal shop and a bunch of space for artists. And when we rented this warehouse, it came with a beautiful gallery space. So what we do there is every couple of months we host a show. Since we're a newer venue, I really wanted to host a show with some purpose and importance, and that's what inspired the idea for the original show. This is a continuation of that show. It's coming down, and next week we'll be hosting the Thrift Store Prom, and there will be redone Thrift Store artwork as our new gallery show connected to the space.
Very cool. So for more about this event, who do you hope comes out?
So right now, our list of speakers is for Friday night. We've got Bridgeworks Oregon, and they published a book called Prisons Have a Long Memory, and it's stories written by currently incarcerated people, all prompts in response to questions from fifth graders. It's a really interesting collaboration. And then we have three different formerly incarcerated speakers on the panel, including a woman who had a pretty tragic domestic violence situation, and she's talking about what she's doing with her probation officer now, which is kind of startling. So really important stuff for people to know. And then we also have our founder, who's Brandon Morlock, and he started Past Lives. He was incarcerated for 5.5 years. And we have a few other organizations coming in. So we have the Metropolitan Public Defenders, and then Rima from Let Us Grow teaches gardening inside the prisons, and then also Southeast Works, which is a platform that helps people get hired when they're coming out of prison and get housing.
And who do you hope comes to attend?
Everybody. Ideally, people that are curious, that really don't know a lot about the system and how it works. It's a fairly balanced panel. I'm personally not an abolitionist, but I am a reformist. So we will just really want to talk about like what prison is really like, who is it actually helping. We have a panelist that had been a drug addict and gone to prison and really found who they were because they were incarcerated. And then we have people that have gone through sort of the opposite effect where prison was really detrimental to their whole environment. So it's people that just want to know like sort of the broader scope and then are interested in finding out more. And if they want to get involved, how they can get involved in helping.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, kind of stepping back from the event and kind of highlight or talk about the intersection of storytelling and art and its importance in the healing process, but also in just the journey after dealing with that type of trauma of being incarcerated.
Yeah, for me, the big thing that I think I came into Past Lives having long ago connections to people who were incarcerated, but really just sort of living in the mainstream civilian lifestyle. And I just didn't think about people who were in prison. And then I started seeing the artwork that was coming out of prison. And I was like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. This is such a potent reminder that there are human beings that are living right now in prison every day. And some of them for the rest of their lives. And some of them kind of with extreme sentences that don't necessarily belong to the crime. And as a layperson, they just weren't people that I was focusing on. So the art really kind of is a way for me to help communicate their existence. And then the storytelling is kind of in a similar fashion. our space is open to anybody who's been incarcerated to come in and be an artist in the community. Right now, we mostly hire these people to actually do fabrication and commercial construction through our Back to Work program. So we're not fostering a bunch of outside art, but I hope that's something we can get into in the future. And Danny and Tracy from Bridgeworks are looking to do writing workshops for people that are on the other side as well. So it's kind of evolution. We're growing. We've only been at the Space in Past Lives for 7 months. So we're still building out all the things that we're imagining we can do.
If there are people who are listening right now and they're interested in getting involved somehow, what would be a way of getting in the loop?
Yeah, I mean, if they can make it to the event, it's at 6:30. It's at 2808 Southeast 9th Avenue. And if they can't make it to the event, they can just send an email to info@pastlives.space asking for more information. Myself, Brandon Morlock, who's our founder or our membership coordinator, will get back to them and answer any questions they have.
For folks who attend potentially this evening, what do you hope that they walk away with from this conversation event?
Hopefully empowerment. The idea of sort of bridging all these different communities is we're so much stronger when we're speaking to one another. And I really found on the event of the 9th, we had all these different organizations that work with the currently incarcerated but had never met each other. So building bridges between both the organizations that work with people in prison and the community that's interested in getting involved, whether they want to teach or write letters or help us sell the artwork, whatever inspires them to like continue perpetuating the voices of the people that are locked away.
In being involved in this kind of work, do you find that there are common misconceptions that you encounter?
I have seen people sort of make a face when I talk about the fact that we support people coming out of the prison system. But truly, I think most people that come to Past Lives are pretty interested. And the thing that I've found is that the people that have come to us from the prison system are really extraordinary people. There isn't a story or a piece of information that I've gotten from somebody that wasn't somewhat mind-blowing, either what they've been through or what they've overcome or who they were before they lost their way. It's been pretty magnanimous, actually, meeting these people and hearing the changes that they've made since their days of prior. Like, everybody blows my mind in pretty extraordinary ways.
And is it, I just have a question of, is this appropriate for all age groups? Is there an age limit or something for this conversation?
Yeah, there's no age limit, but the domestic violence survivor, her story is a little tough. So I think, you know, it'd be up to the parents' discretion if they want to talk about death and all those other things that come along with that. It's more of an adult content, but I think like maybe 12 and up should be fine.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And can you mention to listeners again when the Call for Light, the conversation is happening and how they can find out more?
Yeah, it's tonight at Past Lives. It is 2808 Southeast 9th Avenue at 6:30. They're welcome to come a little early. And also we have a website, which is pastlives.space, which talks about all the stuff that we do there as well.
Do you have any final thoughts for us before we wrap up?
Thank you so much for your time. And I really hope people will come out and listen. The stories are incredible. And the community is just it's a really positive platform for something that's got so much darkness around it. So I think it'll feel really good to anybody that can show up and learn more.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Past Lives is an organization aiming to do a lot. It's a business. It's a makerspace. It's a new home for artists and creatives. But above all, Past Lives is attempting to amplify the voices of nearly 20,000 people in prison today across Oregon. Since June 2022, a vast 26,000 square foot, two-story warehouse, blocks from the Ross Island Bridge, has been converted into a modern-day guild where anyone can learn trades such as textiles, metalwork, carpentry, or any number of visual arts. But the seeds for this organization were born from tragedy. Brandon Murlock, 28, described the life-changing event that occurred to him 7 years ago that led to the founding of this organization.
I was, I think, one quarter away from entering into my engineering degree when I got in a car accident while experimenting on LSD. I had two friends in the car with me, and one of them died. So I was arrested, and I ended up serving almost 5 years for criminally negligent homicide.
As Murlock adjusted to life inside prison, he started to reflect on what he was seeing through the lens of an engineer. Between stints in Two Rivers and South Fork correctional facilities, Murlock saw untapped potential.
I see this massive captive work pool, in many ways extremely skilled labor force, being exploited in enormous prison industries, warehouses, woodworking, furniture building, metalworking, garments, electronics, anything you can think of.
Murlock also saw how incarcerated adults who brought their talents to prison needed to be resourceful when supplies like paints were limited or not accessible.
Usually when they don't have access to other art supplies or when they're just starting their hustle out, they'll mix instant coffee with like not enough water, so you get kind of a painty, tacky substance, and you can paint in layers with it. So that's one thing. Also, people paint with like Kool-Aid packets. They'll make like watercolors out of like the different flavors of Kool-Aid or Crystallite that sometimes show up on your tray. There's mustard and jelly, and anything that can produce color can end up being turned into artwork.
During my tour of the studio, I asked Ryan McBray, marketing and events director for Past Lives, about an unopened brown envelope I saw on a table that had been sent from an incarcerated person. And so what's in this envelope?
And it looks like we have a pencil drawing of an owl that is wrapped in toilet paper, which makes sense. So it's all graphite.
Oh, that's sick.
It's gorgeous.
This is one of many packages that Past Lives has received from incarcerated people wanting a place to display and sell their work. So I asked Murlock how he got the word out about this new marketplace for those serving time in prisons.
So it started with the network of friends that we already had in prison. The moment that we put it out there that, hey, we will sell your artwork at real market prices and send you the money back, we just started getting an insane influx of artwork. Every day we get new art now.
McBray explained that for any of the pieces sold through Past Lives, artists receive 80% of the proceeds. This Friday, December 9th, from 5:30 to 11 p.m., Past Lives will be hosting its first gallery opening at their warehouse located at 2808 Southeast 9th Avenue. The show is called The Art of Illumination, displaying the work of both incarcerated and non-incarcerated artists. At this show and across the organization, Murlock is convinced Past Lives is filling a larger need in Portland to help people learn new trades in order to gain access to employment, career opportunities, and community.
These are not just things that ex-incarcerated individuals need. Everybody needs respectful, gainful employment and community.
Reporting for KBOO News, this is Owen Bastable.
Whip up my appetite. Don't leave me here high and dry.
are back. Thank you so much for that fantastic interview. Again, that is Call for Light, the conversation happening tonight at 6:30 until 9:30. More information will be up on the website show notes at kboo.fm/thegap.
And this is The Gap. I'm Althea. Tammy's here with me. Normally, this is the call-in portion of the show. Today, we are pre-recorded. If you want to talk to us, you got to do it through Instagram at The Gap Radio or send us an email, thegapradio@gmail.com. Send us a snail mail. It might take a week to get here, but we love to hear from you all the same. But we got some time on our hands to talk about current happenings, what's going on,
the ins and outs,
what we've been up to,
and what we've been feeling.
Yeah,
it's a full holistic approach.
Well, I've been waiting to tell this story. We didn't have time to tell it last week, but Tammy and I went on a little bit of a paint and sip adventure.
We did. It was beautiful.
It was really fun.
I have it in my. I look at it every single day.
Yeah, it's. We did a great job. But you know, if you've never been to a paint and sip, it's basically a painting class. And you know, when you sign up for it, they're like, hey, this is the painting that we're going to teach you how to paint. It's not going to look just like that, obviously. But, you know, you get to sip a little something and paint along, which is super fun. But,
everyone's interpretations of what they're seeing.
Yeah. And interpreting the colors and the instructions and the proportions. Like there's a lot of different variety in that, but tell us about the one fella.
This one fella looking around and he says, I don't know, it just feels like everyone's just painting the same thing. What? Are you kidding? It was okay, I'm not like other girls. Like, geez, you're different. We get it.
Everybody here is just sheep. You go to a painting class and you paint what they taught you to paint.
And it was funny because he painted exactly what
I did. Exact same. There was somebody that, like, you know, had inverted colors and was sort of freeforming.
It was cool, yeah. Like, I like theirs, yeah.
But I mean,
so funny. It's I don't know what that is.
And then
he was
out in the street, like flapping it around.
I was judging him the whole time.
Well, yeah, when Tammy told me that, we were just cracking him.
So, I don't know. I felt that he looked like maybe it was a date. I'm just assuming it was a date, but no, I wasn't happy. No one was happy after we heard that.
Babe, everyone here is like kind of sheeple if you think about it.
It was a great experience.
To say one thing about him.
Oh, please.
I feel like it's an example of, like, you see what you want to see, you know? Like, if you already have the preconceived notion that it's like, everybody's the same and nobody's an individual, and then you go to a painting class, so, like, there's irony in that, and you're like, wow, everybody painted a vase, or, like, everybody painted a forest. Like, that's literally, you're a sheep, you know? Versus if you are coming at it from everybody has their own necessarily unique take on this. Mm-hmm. The color of everybody's sky is different.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody did it in their own way. Then that's what you'll see. That's what you'll notice about it. So I think it's really, you know, seek and ye shall find or whatever.
Put it down in writing. Yeah, it is. I love that experience. And it's probably, we could probably replicate it for way cheaper, but we can take that offline.
Yeah.
Maybe we can offer a sip and paint lesson with us for the next membership drive or something.
That'd be fun.
Auction ourselves out. I'll figure out a nicer way of putting that.
Maybe we'll rephrase that when the time comes.
Workshopping it.
What could we paint? I would also have to feel like I could credibly teach someone to paint. But maybe it's ironic. And it's like, we also aren't that good at painting it.
I love how there's all this art conversation with what we're talking about now and the conversation and the gallery.
Yeah.
I just, that take of looking at what you see what you
want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Or what you, I don't want to say it, but manifesting things.
Uh-huh.
God, I hate myself for saying that.
No, you don't have to hate yourself.
But yeah, so for folks who aren't familiar with the show, or I guess we usually have a call-in question, but unfortunately today, because we are pre-recorded, we don't have a call-in question, and we can't take your calls, but we can talk to you on the internet. And I guess I have a question. What's been on your mind? Personally, spiritually, politically?
Whoa.
City Hallsy?
Well, yeah, I want to do a City Hall thing, but you just reminded me of something with all of the art talk, which I think I've done this bit on the show before, which isn't saying much because we've had the show for a while and I have similar things to say. But just that there is, and the one that about this, you know, painting class that we went to, there was a lot of, like, shedding that perfectionism and shedding that you wanted to be a certain way. And I really believe that. There was like a, there's an Instagram account that I kind of learned that from in like college or something that was like, hey, make bad art. Like, art doesn't have to be good. If it's, first of all, it's good for you. So like if you're a health nut and you can get your head around the idea that it would be good for you, then that's one way to get motivated around it. But like, it doesn't need to be good. It's just doing it is what's good, you know? And so many people will be like, oh, I'll never do that, or I could never try, because they're not prepared to be good. And for a lot of us, you know, like, we haven't we haven't worked on, you know, learning new skills since we were kids, maybe. And so like that frustration, or like not feeling like you're gonna stick to it. And if it's not a skill that's tied to, well, I'm gonna turn this into my career.
Sure, sure.
You know, it's like then you're just investing time, you know, but there's value in it anyway. And you have my permission to make bad art.
Well, on top of it, and okay, we'll get to the politics.
We just got plenty of time for politics.
Taxes and death. It also makes me think of how I know personally, if I do pick up a new hobby, because I love hobbies and learning new things, I like with my resin art, I really enjoy the resin art, and I felt like I need to in some way like make resin art and try to sell it and call myself a maker or something like that. And I don't want to. I have absolutely no interest in like selling stuff and creating an Etsy shop and monetizing it. And I had to like really understand that and like have it be okay.
Yeah.
And it's like so weird. Because it is fun to like capture like the creating process, the creative process. It's very, really cool. But there's something about, I don't know, it's like just creating like a constant like producing content or something, you know. Yeah. It's like making it, it's like, so is pouring resin my hobby or creating the content my hobby, you know?
Yeah.
So and I realized that I don't want to create content. I want to just do this and be free of having to feel like some sort of obligation to it. But and that's been really freeing, because it's like I can pick up a hobby and not get super into it. I can just like try it out and do it whenever I'm bored or whenever I feel like doing it, and not invest so much in it. And I don't know. It just seems a lot more of a genuine interaction for me.
Totally. And one thing that I will say, as somebody who has dabbled in many crafts and has collected many craft supplies, check out if you're interested in a type of craft, and I think resin is maybe an exception to this idea, but if you're interested in a type of craft, like, check out your thrift store, check out creative reuse, like scrap, you know, like if you're like, I want to try painting, I don't want to invest in something nice, get like people stuff that they didn't want, test it out, see if you like it, and then you can invest in the good stuff.
There's always at the dollar store, there's a whole art section. You can get felt.
Dollar store is fantastic.
The felt, unbelievable.
Like, my whole, I make miniatures, and a lot of those supplies come from the dollar store, primarily foam core board.
That's true. They do have a bunch of that foam.
Foam core board.
And a lot of fake shrubberies and all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that you can get out there and get making. And just, I mean, I try to have, like, I have a collage in my journal that I do every month. And I try to, like, you know, no matter how busy I get, it's like, you have to do a little bit of this creativity. And it doesn't have to be good, you know? Because also when you're older, or somewhere in your life, you'll look back and you'll say, like, oh, that was cool that I, like, taught myself crochet. Or,
oh, yeah,
that I found this little, cut out these scraps out of the newspaper and made a ransom note or something, you know?
It's 100%. It's and then I think when you interact with things, when I taught myself an instrument, like within the last like 10 years, I'm like, oh, the way I interact with like learning things is so, it's exactly how I interact with like myself and people. And it's a lot of like, because when you know that thing when you find something challenging and you're a beginner and you mess up, or it doesn't look good, or it doesn't come out the way that you want it, it teaches you to like, A, be kind with yourself. Like, what are you going to do? Just give up.
Yeah.
But also like, just like, like when you're challenged, like in life, we're challenged at every day. Like, you know, you're walking down the street and you step on like gum or something, or like you maybe go a little bit too much in the speed limit and then you get, you know, pulled over, or, I don't know, a million things that isn't really your, you know, whatever. And it's a challenge. Like, we have a bunch of challenges that we're always facing. Yeah. And when it's one that's, like, a hobby that, like, you're kind of like, but I like doing this, but I I'm not at the level where I'm producing it, like, how I want it to, but I will, but all it takes is, like, getting over this hump.
Yeah.
And that, and it's, and it's different in a way, because it's not like a challenge as in, like, getting a ticket that now, like, you know, or your car is broken and you have to, like, fix it or something. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. It's like, I don't know. It's like it's your face. Like, no one is making you do this.
Yeah.
It's like you're facing yourself, and it's like, how many times, you know, have you or listeners, they're, like, trying something new and they're like, ah, I give up. Yeah. And it's like that's only for yourself. Like, you know, why are we so easy to give up on ourselves versus mm-hmm. when someone else is making us do something, you know?
Yeah. It's okay to be bad at stuff. It really is. And I mean, a lot of my like interest in art and not monetizing it and just doing it for fun, like I'm always chasing that flow state, you know, where you're just like, ooh, these ideas, they're popping into my head left and right. Here's a creative problem solving kind of thing I could do. It's good for you and it's fun and it's good for the spirit, you know? Anyway, make bad art. That's the thesis of this.
But write it down, even if it's bad.
Write it down. Are you wanting to pivot into some political?
Okay, we can switch some gears, and give a little bit of treatment to what's been going on, because it's been a lot and we can't get to all of it. But oh boy, are we? We're looking at a lot. There's been a lot that's happening this week. International, local, the earthquake, you know, I just want to acknowledge that's been, oh my God, the images, unbelievable.
Devastating.
Yeah. And seeing all the people coming together and, you know, now it's, you know, we're seeing kind of like the aftermath, but it's something that people are going to be having to deal with for weeks and months and years to come. So, big, I don't know, hug to everyone that's dealing with that and people in our communities that are, you know, dealing with it also, because it's not, you know, doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah, so sad.
And it's I feel like everywhere is hurting also. So just big hugs to everywhere that's hurting.
It's like the 1 year anniversary of like the disastrous floods in Pakistan.
Mm.
There's sometimes, natural disasters are an opportunity for us to bridge the gap. You know,
there it is.
And understand that there are some basic needs that we ought to be providing for each other. In a pivot to something a little sillier, if you'll allow me, you guys have heard of the OLCC, I'm sure.
Focusing back on Oregon,
the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission.
Oh, as the OLCC is nothing to bleep with.
Yeah,
that with fear.
They're gonna come get you, dude. No, Governor Tina Kotek is cleaning house, demanding that heads roll at the OLCC because of rare, valuable, expensive liquors.
That's a lot of rare, valuable. Like, that's a lot of adverbs.
It is. I want to
just
clarify to
really
get
the point across.
So the OLCC kind of regulates the sale of these really expensive things. So some of them get set aside for, you know, anybody to buy. Some of them get set aside for bars, for restaurants, for specialty stores, et cetera. And then there's some of them that through the OLCC, they have a lottery system that you as an individual could enter into and get like a really expensive bottle of something for way under market value. Like, you go to Washington or California, you're paying, you know, a private market price that is reflective of how rare it is, right? And wouldn't you know it, but an internal investigation seems to suggest, and it hasn't been released yet, that the leaders at OLCC were sort of sliding those to their friends, kind of a thing. I think it was from the Mercury, somebody said, I mean, like, oh yeah, that's bad. We don't like the OLCC, but I probably would have done it too.
With the discourse under these stories for the, I think it's a Mercury or the Willamette, one of them had it. And it's, oh man, never before has the city been divided.
Oh, really?
Over something. And I get it. Part of me is this. You can't see I'm doing the world's smallest violin. Oh, you can't get your alcohol. Well, drink Old Crow like the rest of us. What do you mean? And another part of me.
Do an investigation of what they're doing to all the damn eggs. Go ahead.
Whoa.
The eggs are expensive. That's the
difference. I'm not co-signing on that. Okay, what is this? So in one part, it's drink old crow like the rest of us and in this economy. But then another part of me is like, well, ask any person who's worked in like the cannabis side of the OLCC's supervision and you get one metric number off. And I read it all the time where the facilitators are the facilitators and manufacturers, where they are held to, like, they are under a microscopic lens. And I understand, you know, there's all this speculation, like, well, because it's not federally regulated or because it's considered a blah, 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 blah. That's what I hear when people say that, because it's like, if you're going to try to tell me that alcohol is in any way more strong than cannabis, I'm just going to tell you that you're a liar. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I understand that I do think that the lawmakers or the people who are enforcing the laws are not in any way above it. If anything, they should be leading by example, you know? It's some people were saying like, hey, isn't this what you do when you have a job like this? You gotta like hook up your friends. And I guess I couldn't find anywhere that said that they like stole it or didn't pay for it, you know? But also, so again, world's smallest violin, want thousands of dollars worth. That's, I get into any, and also, I understand that the lawmakers should be held to, you know, accountable.
Yeah,
and
I guess they're bureaucrats.
Also, you know, I mean, yeah, and I get it. And it just, there's so many other bureaucrats who are doing much worse things that it's like, this is, it's just like fodder, but also, it's not. So I'm very conflicted, as you can see.
Yeah, yeah. Mostly, most of the response was like, what? The OLCC? Do something wrong. not be 100% above board. And I think that Tina Kotek already forced out the head at the beginning of the month. He was either fired or forced to resign.
A lot of being forced to resign happening around. Something's in the air.
Something's in the air. Something's in the water.
In the eggs.
In the eggs.
Speaking of money.
Okay.
Segway queen over here.
Yes.
Housing Multnomah now.
Yeah, let's
got
talk
a,
about
a
it.
Chunk of money.
$14 million planned for this year by the county to put people in apartments. I find it to be pretty encouraging. I don't believe it's been fully approved yet, but County Chair in Multnomah, Jessica Vega Peterson, had the release this week.
The Housing Multnomah Now is that's what the plan is called.
Yes.
And the plan itself is to allocate the $14 million.
It's extra money from the Metro Housing Bond, I believe.
Hmm.
Leftover stuff that's not already allocated to the joint office, I believe. And they're going to try to focus on getting people housed in the, like, people who are unsheltered, experiencing unsheltered homelessness, get them to have housing in the neighborhood that they're already in. So focusing on downtown, on the Central East Side area. County initiative. So focusing first on Portland and then taking it to the east part of the county to get people into houses with supportive services is a big part of it as
Sure. And there's the kind of the other, component of Urban Alchemy, which was the contractor that was a no-bid contract that, was it Dan Ryan or?
It's hard to say if it was Ryan or Wheeler.
Okay.
Because also, I don't know if we talked about this, but Wheeler took Ryan off the Housing Bureau and he put Carmen Rubio on it.
It's another person to do nothing. Okay.
I think. I'm pretty sure that's true.
Oh, yes, that is true. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then also, and then the whole Zenith thing, let's not get into it. But basically, with the Wheeler's plan, Sam Adams's plan, to build mass camps for people to have to camp in, basically, in the city, they had a partner. Or they were just like, yeah, this random company from California, Urban Alchemy.
No bid contract.
Which also Urban Alchemy like started in the pandemic as like hand washing stations. But anyway, that they were going to contract with them, you know, no questions asked.
California company.
And they got the bid from Urban Alchemy. And they're saying it will cost $51 million a year to run these mass camps. That they're like these 150 person camps that checks out to about $34,000 per person per year to operate these campsites. Versus, you could put somebody up in a studio apartment for $15,000 a year. So that's less than half. And then if you allocated $15,000 for supportive services, for example, you know, behavioral health treatment, addiction services, helping somebody find a job, all of that, if you spent $15,000 on that, that would still be cheaper than forcing people, criminalizing homelessness and forcing them into camps.
But then there wouldn't be a middleman getting paid to do all of it, which would be the urban urban alchemy.
Yeah, it's a little bit, it seems like profiteering. And the benefit of a cheaper plan would be people have housing. And, I mean, the vitriol against a Housing First initiative is crazy. But it's fundamental to getting stable, you know, is like having somewhere to be, having somewhere where your stuff is. We know that.
And it's a safe place where your stuff is. Yeah. It isn't just out in the open and or like even in a shelter, you know, in a shelter. It's not like you have your own space in any way whatsoever.
Yeah. And I mean, I made the mistake of looking at Twitter and seeing what people were saying about it. And they're like,
were they not being nice? That's shocking.
Would you believe that the denizens of Twitter were not stoked on this idea? But I mean, yeah, I think the Housing Multnomah plan is by far the most encouraging thing that I've heard. And a lot of their focus is like quick turnaround, you know, because in terms of affordable housing, people wait years to get vouchers or to even get on the list, to get on the list, you know. And so what they're trying to do is speed that up. And they're saying that the camps might be part of it. It's like, hey, you know, you're going to have to spend 15 days in this camp or whatever. And then we'll be ready to get you in the system and make sure that you have support that you need to find a job and get going, you know. But the people at Twitter, they're like, oh, good. You know, free housing for lazy people.
That's the argument. I guess that's the argument on that.
They're like, when do working people get a break? I'm like, you're so close. You're so close to seeing what's going on. They're like, when will working people get a reward? It's like,
that's a good question. Let's explore that.
Yes, you know? And. Yeah. Yes, and when will working people get a break? And when will working be enough? You know what I mean? In this system that doesn't ultimately put you in jeopardy of being in the very same position, you know?
And it makes me so sad to not, I mean, it bewilders me. I just get so confused when people are just so, it's like you have your basic needs met.
Yeah.
And that's where you're able to kind of like go off.
Yeah.
And you say, why can't this person do A, B, and C without having their basic needs met?
Yeah.
So it's like, if things are hard for you and you have a place to live and a bed
and
electricity and running water
and
let's say money for a bus pass or for gas, you know, and you don't have to like resort to different ways of surviving, like then shut up. Like this isn't like, you're not making any sense and you're coming off very cruel. And I understand that it's hard to see and that you, and I do think that people just feel like it's really hard to see and it's a maybe coming from a place of feeling hopelessness and in a way feeling mercy, but it's coming out in a way that's really cruel and vicious and
ugly.
Yes, and ugly. And the only people who can hear that are people who have like an agenda, you know, to like come in and be super brutal instead of try to, you know, like you said, like have housing, like, because the problem is housing. It's not that you see this, it's that you see this and it bothers you. It seeing this bothers everyone. And how is the next step? We need to demolish this versus like, we, you know, by sweeping and by calling the cops and by being completely inhumane. And I mean, people do some things that are terrible, like cutting people's tents and pouring water in freezing temperatures. And how is that
sense? How is that the response? And here's the other thing is like, we haven't really pursued a housing first solution in the past. And would you believe that everything else we've tried hasn't worked a damn, you know? And so the idea that we would spend more money to criminalize people mm-hmm. for the crime of being alive and not having a house is ridiculous, you know? And like when you see, I guess just like seeing your city government, and there's flaws up and down the entire system. I'm not like going to argue that like supportive services are perfect every time, you know? But like it's just not the case that this is, that all we can hope for is like pushing poor people out of town, you know? And people also come at it from the drug angle and worried about Measure 110 that decriminalized small amounts of drugs. And they're saying, get rid of Measure 110. It was a huge mistake. Address the issue. The issue is people doing drugs.
Because people in houses don't do drugs.
That's what I'm saying. Like our drug problem doesn't also happen behind four walls, mm-hmm. okay? If you really want to address it, then address all of it, mm-hmm. you know? Not just the people that you see, mm-hmm. you know? And also, I think it's just worth mentioning because people are like, Measure 110, what a failure. You know, sorry, I didn't mean to adopt that voice. Measure 110, what a failure. because, you know, people of all different accents would say that. But Measure 110, we haven't gotten to see it in action yet. It took a while for the Oregon Health Authority to get their ducks in a row mm-hmm. so that people can actually get diverted to supportive services. And also, the data doesn't support that there's an uptick in drug use. We don't know about overdose deaths yet. But what we do know is law enforcement pushing the narrative that it is a big problem and that it's ruined things for them. And I don't think they have great credibility about what is good and bad.
Mm.
If I can say that, if I can be so bold, and I'd love for them to build their credibility by being right once in a while, mm-hmm. but it doesn't often happen. Anyway, I'm perturbed about the Measure 110 thing, you know?
Well, it also, you know, maybe...
People don't want to be addicted to drugs.
Sure.
You know?
And maybe this is a reach, so tell me if this is a reach, okay. but it just... Criminalizing people who use drugs, criminalize it in a way that's not getting to the root of the problem, as in, you know, addiction, or people who are in house and criminalizing being poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's that aspect. And then there's the fact that in Oregon, you know, as far as the language in the Constitution, slavery can only be applied in the prisons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a measure to take that language out and voted against it. So, I don't know, it's just that criminalization and the fact that slavery is alive in the prison system, like, I don't know, it's just, I just think, just more free labor, you know, like this is, it's like got the claws, like this, like, I don't know, it's like the system has the claws in the people who are most susceptible or most vulnerable. And it's never ending until we allow to break it, you know, like individually, like, you know, like there's ways that we can let things slide, or there's ways that we can, I don't know, just put the ego aside for a second and just look at the humanity in a person and take that however you want. You know, maybe it is giving someone a dollar in the street. Maybe it is doing a tow for someone for a little cheaper than you usually do just because you see that they're in dire straits, you know, like it just these little things that can, these little challenges that, like, I don't know, like we're all dealing with them in different ways and just like not seeing the humanity and just like we're not collateral damage. That's not, you know, we have names and we have opinions and we have families and we have friends and we have beliefs. And it just like the system just turns us into poor haves, have nots. And eventually the have nots end up just being free labor.
Yeah. And I think it's important to notice that this system perpetuates itself by making you think that it's a personal moral failing of anybody who is in dire straits.
Yeah.
And, you know, take that back to its sort of puritanical Christian roots if you want to. But one thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is like the scarcity mindset, which, you know, is like a very capitalist thing to be ingrained in us that we don't even realize that we have, but that there's a scarcity. There's this idea of scarcity, you know? and that we are playing a zero-sum game, meaning that only one person can win. And that if I'm doing well, necessarily somebody else has to be doing worse than me, because that's what defines me doing well. And it, like, it feeds jealousy, you know, and none of us are above these things.
Sure,
but
sure.
Like, understanding when you've been, you know, infiltrated, I guess, by a scarcity mentality where, you're punching ghosts, basically, because what you're thinking about is not you're worried about scarcity when there is no scarcity.
It's like, it makes me think of how all these tech companies are laying off people and just all the huge layoffs that we saw post-pandemic or, you know, like, at post-lockdowns and during lockdowns, and how this was coming on the heels of them making record profits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's like, I don't know, that's just kind of what woke that up for me,
what
you were saying.
Yeah, and that, like, you know, that there isn't enough abundance in whatever way you want to characterize it.
There isn't
enough food, there isn't enough money in our society that we can dream a little bigger, people ought to have health care and somewhere to live.
We are creative.
You know?
We can do it. We've done it before.
And I mean, it also goes to, you know, how individualistic of a society, you know, the United States is, that we, one, assume that somebody's success is theirs alone.
Mm-hmm.
Nepo baby conversation.
Bootstraps.
Yeah, exactly. And that, like, that you've done everything by, you have to do everything by yourself, and that, you know.
As though the Homestead Act isn't a thing. Wake that up.
Yeah,
I'll never forget that.
No, I mean, I think the Homestead Act, you know, affirmative action in colleges benefited white women the most. You know, like, just all of these things that, yeah, anyway, what were you going to say?
You're 100% right. And it's infuriating because it's we perpetuated a narrative that then we act out at the polls.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that conversation of misinformation and disinformation of, you know, gaining, you know, trust as far as creating a narrative and just getting involved with the community, because I think people see that things are rough, like, we're all feeling it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, and it's the easy answers are usually not the right ones. Like, I don't know, I feel like if someone's like, I know exactly what you should do, I always kind of question a person when, you know, when they say that, or, and they're like, I know 100% what, you know, what the right answer is. This is 100% right. It's
complex problems require complex solutions.
And it's a bit, I don't know, it's like this thing where it's like, oh yeah, we're the ones that are going to figure it out, you know, we're going to, you know, delete everything and start from scratch. And sometimes that's I don't know, there's always something to base things on, you know, like, we can always rebuild.
Yeah.
But there's, whether it's, I don't know, the spirit or just the course correction comes to mind.
And then I think also acknowledging that how our world has changed, you know, like, I think that there's
rapid
this kind of, like, backlash that comes from, like, well, it used to be this way, why is this suddenly a problem now, why is suddenly everybody addicted to opioids,
we can start, like, or high right, value
love,
women
yeah I would love to you know, like, I think just, like, recognizing that we can't go back to the past. We really literally legitimately cannot. But we can build new solutions to the future,
sure,
because our problems come from the past, but they don't have to be in the future, you know? And so, yeah, I guess just being infuriated by these things that are, you know, trying to, and look, a rising tide lifts all ships, you know? It's, if you're a small business owner, it's good for your business if the people in your community have housing and can get a job relatively easily and be able to, you know, influx cash into your business or whatever.
What you said about our problems coming from the past.
Yeah.
It's, and then people would say, you know, kind of going back to, like, a lot of conversations online with, like, you know, cishet women have to be this way, and now women are too educated and too free, and they're they're going to college and going on vacation and getting jobs, and they're in, like, conversations around, like, the whole Me Too movement of, like, men used to be able to do, like, you can't say anything anymore. Men used to be able to do whatever they wanted at the workplace, and it's like, what what was the reality of when, yeah, when all this was for the people, yeah, not for the dudes, like for the women,
right,
you know, what was the actual reality for everyone else besides the people who are saying it used to be better,
yeah,
and the reality that it was bad, like that, you know, women couldn't have a credit card until the 70s. Like,
they were on
that is
uppers, downers, and
unbelievable to me.
Through the day, yeah.
Like, when people have on it, like, honest conversation, like, they are honestly saying things like, women in the workplace is a bad thing because it's distracting to men, or,
yeah,
you know, like, these conversations of, like, and it all goes back to this idea of, like, I don't want to say whiteness as like a race, but like this idea of like preserving something of the past.
White supremacy culture.
That if something else comes into it, or mm-hmm, if something else is on the same level of it, then it somehow diminishes, you know?
Yeah.
So dudes are like...
And that's scarcity mindset.
And it's a...
It's interconnected.
I'm digesting that because that's... Is it scarcity? Is it... That fear of, yeah, if this person, you know, like thinking of white flight, for example, in the course of gentrification, and when it comes in, it's like, if these XYZ people come in, what does that mean about like the property value? What does that mean about me as a person who lives in a place of this property value?
Yeah.
And it means nothing. Like,
yeah,
it means,
yeah,
absolutely nothing, but
yeah,
is it a scarcity?
I think
something to chew on there.
The making it, figuring out what is, and we've talked about this on the show before, of like things that, and this was, I think we talked about it with the gas stoves. It's like, is this actually central to your personal identity?
Mm.
The idea of using a gas stove. Because here's the thing. Gas stoves were like popularized less than 100 years ago. There is not some great tradition back to caveman times of you like, and I mean, traditionalist arguments are goofy anyways a lot of the time, but like,
that's a word. Yeah.
I think like pulling apart what is actually part of your identity. And I find it to be helpful when I'm feeling bad, or I'm feeling jealous, or I'm feeling like I haven't accomplished enough, or I haven't done all of these things that I feel like I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm.
Like recognizing, like, do I think that like my measure of success is based on somebody else doing worse, you know?
Mm.
Or like, how do I measure success, and what does that mean that I've internalized about what is good and bad, you know?
Mm.
Maybe this is too esoteric. I wanted to mention one other fact, because this did start with a conversation about trying to address the homelessness crisis,
mm-hmm,
in Portland, in the metro area, and in Oregon broadly. It's a crisis. It's a new problem to have. We need a new solution. Contrary to what people might believe, Portland ranks pretty low for the violent crime rate, along with Seattle and New York City, despite the fact that sometimes if you leave this area, people are like, oh, you live in Portland? Like, are you okay?
And the rats don't own the city.
The rats don't run this city. We do. I think I've told this story too, but I visited some friends in Santa Cruz, and someone was like, oh, you live in Portland? And I was like, yeah, like bracing for the question of like, what's it like? Like, are you okay? You know, that whole thing. And they're like, oh, we went to the breweries up there one time. Like, the breweries are great. And I was like, oh my God, the breweries. I forgot that we were known for other things.
The airport.
Yeah, the cool airport carpet. But just that, what is real? What is crime? Mm. And what is a perceived crime, which is visible homelessness and a feeling, you know? And not to, you know, go in on the Willamette Week, but they
Uh-oh.
Did run, they ran this thing last week about like, these are the people leaving Portland. And then this week they were like, here's 26 cool things about Portland that could make you want to stay.
They're a complex cookie up in there.
The Mercury had a field day with that one. They're like, oh, rich people are leaving. Ooh.
The Mercury gets a little too spicy for me. So I'm like, what's going on here? It's very spicy.
We need a dialogue in this world.
I'm here for it. I'm here for it. But I think this is kind of where we have to stop for the day.
If you have thoughts, please do let us know. You can message us on Instagram at The Gap Radio. I'll try to have a story up if you want to respond to, you know, what we're talking about. You can email us, thegapradio@gmail.com. You can send us stuff, maybe a postcard. We love postcards. To The Gap, courtesy of KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214.
Yes, and again, don't forget, there is the Call for Light conversation happening at the Past Life Gallery tonight, starting at 6:30.
Yep.
And yeah, hopefully we'll be back next week in Poison.
We're hoping to be live next week, so look for us then. And yeah, check out the show notes, kbu.fm/thegap.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been Althea.
I have been, will be, and am the one and only Tammy.
Scarcity mindset. Thank you guys so much for listening.
Have a fun weekend.
We'll be back next week. Goodbye. Bye.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films throughout the month of February, with a collection of films by African directors from over 16 nations.
Films will be screened at Cascade PCC, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, showing Africa through African lenses, happening February 3rd until Saturday, March 4th, in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the